So, welcome to today's podcast. I have Mr. Ross Tavendale finally. Ross, I've only been asking you for about, I think maybe close on a year now. I'm not sure it's been that long. 6 months to come on my podcast and finally we get a hold of you. So, good to have you.
I'm a bit of a slut for the numbers, Craig. I was actually just waiting until you got your subscriber base up, so I didn't waste my time.
You're probably not even kidding either. But
no, it's busy diaries. It's hard to pin you down as well. Our agency's been growing at an extreme rate, and finding the time to do things is always challenging. But I'm glad we've finally been able to get this scheduled in, because I'm pretty sure you've got... You're ready to give me an absolute roasting, so I'll be interested if you can ask.
Not roasting as such, but obviously your journey and you know, things that are going on and how you do things and the type of people you work with are all very interesting compared to the way we work. So obviously we are quite good friends and we talk a lot, and you know, at events where we get on really well and stuff, but we are opposites in terms of, you know, where we work and the way we conduct ourselves and all of that kind of stuff. And you run an agency, I hate agencies. You're Mr. Corporate, I'm Mr. you know, whatever. I'm not even going to say Mr. Scumbag. But
no, you're the laptop entrepreneur. You're like the freewheeling entrepreneur and I'm Mr. Corporate.
So we do have opposites in, you know, a lot of respects in terms of business. And obviously, that's, you know, sometimes it's good to hear, you know, some of the stuff that you do, and some, because I'm not working with the same type of people that you are and stuff like that. So first off, obviously, for anyone who doesn't know of Ross, who's listening, he's the owner of Taipei Media in London, the face of Canonical Chronicle, who I'm sure you don't really need an introduction, to be honest, but how long have you been doing the Taipei Media thing for? Is it probably about 4 or 5 years?
No, much less than that. So this is the second corporation tax bill we're about to pay. So we're actually less than 3 years old, or the brand Taipei Media is less than 3 years old. Feels like it's been around for a lot longer. I moved to London about 6 years ago and bought in to an agency called Ideas Made. Now, buy-in sounds very grand. I was either going to buy a house or buy a business, and I thought, well, I've seen the prices in Glasgow versus prices in London are a wee bit different. So that was the house buying out the window pretty quickly. And I bought into that business. The guy I went into business with had web design. So he had like Peroni and Red Bull and all that, and The Guardian as a client. And the idea we were meant to cross sell to each other, but we very quickly realized that the guy who's in charge of designing the new Peroni website is not the guy doing the SEO. In fact, they're not even the same department. They don't even know who each other is. It's very hard to cross-sell. So 2 years later, 3 years later, we decided we're just going to go back to running our own thing. And that's when Taipei was born.
So a little bit about when you started, because I think I started to get to know you when Taipei Media was just starting. That time we spoke together in London a few years ago. I think, did you work in a metal container, or did I just make that up?
No, you're right. So we're a bootstrapped agency. So that means that everything that I've built has come from my personal savings account. And when you're bootstrapping and you don't have any money and you need an office space in London, and someone says, you can work inside this shipping container and it'll be 600 quid a month and you can fit 10 people in it, I'm like, okay, what's the downsides? He's like, well, it's Portaloos outside. So we spent a year of our lives as a growing fledgling agency. If it was raining and we had to go for a pee, you were getting wet. It's as simple as that.
What are the that? Were these places kitted out properly, like with like proper walls, or was it literally your back was against the metal?
Oh, no. So, like, it was fitted out with, like, a floor and walls and things like that, like Wi-Fi and electricity and things. It was pretty basic. And it was in a place called Elephant and Castle, which sounds quite fancy. It is, like, is the... I'd call the arsehole of... Am I allowed to swear? I suppose
I'm not
swearing. It's the arsehole of London. It is an absolute shit show in Elephant and Castle. And we would have homeless guys coming in, stinking of piss, being like, oh, can I get a fat? Like, and I'd always stupidly give them money when they just kept coming back and coming back. I'd have a guy, we were on the ground level as well, so people would just walk in and be like, oh, I've got an idea for an app. And I'm like, oh, God. So a lot of nutters, a lot of people coming in trying to sell CDs and all that. We got robbed a couple of times. Like,
really?
It was horrible.
Hell. Nah, interesting, but it's nice to see, you know, when I started my agency, I was slumming it. I think my first office bill came off the credit card and all that kind of stuff. So I've been there and slummed it as well. And I think it's great to see. One thing that, you know, I slagged you off for is the amount of times that you move office. So how many times in that couple of years have you actually moved office? It must be five or more. Got to be.
Yeah, it's been four times in 3 years, five times over 4 years when it was Ideas Made, then Taipei. We just keep growing, and the thing is, because we're bootstrapped, we can't just walk into a 2,000-square-foot gorgeous place. And the idea of going to something like WeWork, where it's £600 to £700 per person per desk for like a postage stamp size office, is just not worth it. And we want to put our own stamp on it and control it and brand it and things. So we just keep moving. So we first moved into a place in Clapham. We shared an office. So from the shipping container, we then shared an office with an estate agent. They had some spare desks. So that was a big step up because they had indoor plumbing. and then after the estate agent, we then moved to our own little place, 300 square feet, which is the size of, I don't know, like a small living room. We ended up putting about six people in that office. And then when we realized we needed to add another four people to the business, we actually got rid of the tables and just got smaller tables to make more space. So the guys were absolutely raging. They came in one day and they had these little tiny coffee table things pushed up against the wall, middle of summer. It was absolutely horrible. But we fit 10 people in there. And then we moved into the current studio, which is where we are, which has got a nice dedicated video studio with my little fancy SEO is dead neon. And that's 800 square feet. It's its own kitchen, its own bathroom and all that sort of thing, which is basic. Everyone's like, so what? It's got its own bathroom.
You're in luxury now compared to where you've been.
Exactly.
You could even stay overnight in there if you had to.
Yeah. Pretty nice. So it's been a fast journey, and that's just because I work all the time. But it feels nice to go from when I had no kind of real prospects. When I first moved here, I moved into a flat shared with another four people, mice, cockroaches, the whole deal. The guy, actually, one of the guys that I live with, I found out he was a cocaine addict. I'd get up and go to work at 6 o'clock in the morning. And he was still up from the night before. I was like, ah. So some pretty horrific stuff, but the rent was £400 a month. So I could live off of a grand a month comfortably in London, which is unusual. And because of that, all the money stayed in the business, and it stayed in it for a very long time. And because of that thinking, now with all this coronavirus stuff happening and clients cancelling or pausing, we've got enough money in our bank account that we're never going to need to fire anyone or make anyone redundant. So it paid off.
That's all thanks to you sleeping with rats and cockroaches and various other bits and bobs. But I think it's a great journey to experience that. But as you know, anyone will tell you, I mean, that's a long time. That's several years. I mean, I know you've recently in the last 6 months moved into your, you know, nice new apartment and all that kind of stuff, overlooking the Thames, and things are all going. But surely building a business and then going home to sleep with cockroaches are, I think, one of the things that always sticks in my mind that you told me that you were going to have a shower and people had potentially snotted on the tiles. And, you know, you're thinking that you've, you know, got a bit of shampoo or something on you from the previous person. It's not, it's snot and stuff. I mean, how do you motivate yourself? I mean, surely you must have been in that shower some days going, just kill me now. Kill me now. This is no good. Or, you know, was the kind of looking at the bank balance and storing all your money what made you keep going with that?
Yeah, I think when you've got a bit of a... Nietzsche said that if you've got a why, you can bear almost any how, which I think is pretty much where my head was at. when you're seeing, when you're, it was all self-inflicted. Like, I could move back to Glasgow in 2 seconds and live in a nice place. So, like, if it was forced upon me, I would have felt differently about it. But because I was choosing to do it, it was actually quite fun to, like, it felt like I was part of something and I was doing something that felt meaningful. So I never felt bad about it. Like, there was obviously times where, like you say, I was in the shower and the guy had spat and snotted all over it, and what I thought was shampoo was actually his bogies and saliva, which was I'm a very clean person, so that did not go down well, to say the least. So there's moments like that where you're like, this is absolutely horrible, and you feel like quitting and throwing in the towel. But when you then see your bank balance going up and up and up, you're getting more clients coming in, you're getting more staff coming on, and you can see a light at the end of the tunnel. I think you need a little bit of hope. Agencies are horrible businesses, because I think it's good training as a businessman, because in terms of, like, dealing with people, dealing with clients, building infrastructure, like, it's all, like, really good training. And I enjoyed it. I love playing at business. And by living in that shithole, you know, I got to play at business, and that was really nice.
So if there's anything, you know, in terms of, you know, starting up and living in a slum and saving up your money, is there anything you would change on that? Or would you say, nah, that was amazing, or, you know, and I would recommend it for anyone? Is that a good apprenticeship, if you like?
It depends. So I come from a police family and a military family. So, like, there's always been there's a big kind of macho thing in my family where, like, not being a pussy is quite important. And I would just give myself that talking to. I'm like, don't be a pussy. Like, I hated myself that on days when I actually first moved to London, I lived in a hostel for a couple of weeks. I couldn't find a place to stay. And I remember, like, in the middle of the night, like, some guy he's begged enough money to get the same hostel room that I'm staying in. And that was grim. That was not nice. But I hated myself I hated how pampered. I felt like I was so pampered that it was causing me huge emotional distress. I hated myself for that. So I think it was good to kind of toughen me up a little bit, because I did come from relative luxury, you know, in, like, the countryside outside of Glasgow. Like, I lived a great life. But in terms of how I'd advise other people to do that, I wouldn't advise anyone who wants to start an agency. Do not do it unless you're financially independent already. I wasn't. I didn't have anything. So I left my first job with 2 months of income. So I had probably $4,000 total and no job, which is not a smart thing to do. But it really motivates you. If you think that you're going to be homeless, it really motivates you. I would never be homeless because I've got enough safety nets to fall through. But I'd recommend becoming a freelancer first, making some money and putting it away, because I would have made much better agency decisions if I had cash. Yeah. Like, did you ever do that? You'd say yes to a client just because you wanted the money, and although you thought they were an absolutely horrific client?
100%. I think I've actually done a podcast recently, and I can't remember who it was with, and we had that conversation where I was taking money at one point in my agency just to pay the bills. I wasn't thinking, is this going to be a good client? Can I grow that client? It was, I need $10,000, for example, to make ends meet, and I need $10,000 worth of clients' money, and I don't give a shit who it is. And that leads to a lot of stress. So I can totally resonate with that.
What about the people? Like, so you had quite a few people that you were employing. Like, that plays into it. So this thing with scale, like, when you get more employees, it's not about you making money and being the big I am businessman. It's about, do I need to make people redundant? Can I pay them so they can pay their mortgages? That's the thing that stresses you out.
It's a stressful thing. And I think it's, you know, it's for some people and not for others. You know, I didn't like having that noose around my neck of having so many people relying on me. And obviously changed approach from being an agency into something else, because, you know, I'm not going to sit there and say I couldn't handle it. Could I run an agency? 100% and stuff like that. But when I was there feeling it, I just felt like claustrophobic. The walls were closing in all the time, and everything was just a stress. Where's the next wage? You know, what if this client pulls out? How am I going to pay everyone on Friday? And it's horrible. And there's a lot of bad sides that people never talk about. Going to business, they always talk about, yeah, I've got, you know, Virgin Airways as the big client, and we've signed that up in a nice 25 grand retainer, and you know, it's locked down in a 12-month contract, so F you everyone. But it's great to hear, you know, that you've literally lived in poverty, and you know, been fighting and scraping your way up, and I think people don't see that about you, and it's not something people are going to talk about a lot either. You know, you're not going to go out there and say, oh, I've lived with cockroaches and I lived with a guy that snotted all over the shower. But I think you're right, it hardens you up, and potentially if you were brought up in a kind of nice, cuddly environment, you know, it certainly probably made more of a man of you. And, you know, I think things happen for a reason. And you've just got to go with the flow. But it's amazing to see you've come out the other side and you know, have the nice studio now. You've got cash in the bank. You've got an apartment where no one's snottering on you, and stuff like that. But talking about the kind of clients you work with, you know, you've obviously been there and you've dealt with all the dicks that everyone deals with out there, you know, guys that you probably wouldn't deal with. But some of the big corporate clients that you deal with, I know you've went down there being the guy in, you know, living in poverty. You know, how do you go and pitch to clients like that when you're living with cockroaches? You know, how were you able to attract that type of client? Was it luck, or is there, you know, give us a clue here, because I need to pitch to some clients with this coronavirus that I'm only kidding on. But
yeah, no, like the sales bit is what everyone is like really scratches their head about, and they're like, oh, how do you get in the room to sell these people? So for people listening, the types of clients we'll work with are, annoyingly, I can't say a lot of them. One of them is an Amazon competitor, which I think there's one in the world. We work with some of the big takeaway companies. We work with the government on a lot of stuff as well. Yeah, so like good size retainers, 15 to 25 grand a month stuff. We work with one of the kind of national beer brands, that sort of thing. The way in which that all works is just by sheer visibility. So I hired a videographer. So my second hire into the agency was a videographer. Now, that doesn't make any sense, because when you're a bootstrapped agency and you're hiring new people, you would hire the SEO guy, the tech guy, the designer, the whatever, not video, because we don't sell video. It was just for me. Mm-hmm. So that was actually my first ever proper hire in that kind of new place, was full-time video. And I've been pushing that out pretty consistently and just having that visibility. If you go on our website, it doesn't rank for shit, and it's actually really hard to contact us. We probably need to design it. But it's all through just being hyper-visible and spending all of the money we saved then goes into advertising. If you look at our YouTube channel, we don't have subscribers, we don't have a ton of engagement, but I do absolutely smash advertising on YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. People have probably been targeted with it pretty consistently. And the thing is, we never sell. So of all the videos, it's never come and work with our agency, buy our stuff. It's always news about SEO, because it's a complicated service and people are smart enough to connect the dots. This guy runs an agency, I can work with them. You don't need to ram it down their throats. A lot of conferences, they really help. Sponsoring conferences, I've done a lot of that. That's been a big, big driving force as well. And doing things like this, like podcasting, and SEMrush has been huge. I actually owe you a massive debt. I don't know if you know this, but you got me into SEMrush back in the day.
I know it's SEMrush have been helpful for me, and I think at the time we've been fortunate, because lots of people ask that question, how did you get on, and you know, this is amazing exposure and everything else. I think it was, you know, a matter of timing. You know, I think Anton said to me, like, do you know anyone else, and you know, good speakers, and I just done that event with you in London, and I was like, man, this guy, you know, knows his stuff and talks very well and everything else. So you were a perfect fit at the right time. But I think that's also the same case with me. When SEMrush picked me up, I was on Alexandra Takalova's Digital Olympus back in 2016. I think it was our first ever one or second one, whatever it was. And the Same Rush approached me from there saying, like, we really like the way you talked. Do you want to come on and do some stuff? So I think it's a, but it's what, more importantly, what you do with it rather than the introduction. The introduction's all good and well, but it's where, you know, you've been able to take that to, you know, and certainly Same Rush, you know, you are Mr. Same Rush now. You've stolen my crown. You know, I think we stood at the last Brighton and I'm looking around, I'm going, his face, his, he is Same Rush. And people used to think that of me, but I was never fortunate enough to have my face plastered all over the stand. So you've taken my title. So
that was a trip. That was, so they get you to sign a waiver to say that we can use your likeness on our advertising, and I'm like, great, you're going to put me in front of more people, on you go. What I didn't realize is that would also mean 7-foot banners in the middle of a conference hall of 4,000 people walking around.
But it's good to see that on there as well. I think you and Greg Gifford are currently, or were at that point, the Mr. Same Rushes, the King and Queen. I'm not sure who the Queen was, but
probably, yeah. Judith. She's pretty prolific on Same Rush. But yeah, they've given me a lot of opportunity and a lot of visibility. But I would never have been able to do that if I didn't have a videographer. And your initial introduction was everything that started it. The funny story about that, when I was doing Canonical Chronicle, I actually pitched them to do it for them. So I was like, I'm going to do this video for you every week. And one of the very high up marketing people who is very well known in the industry, who I'm not going to name any names, they seen the video and they said, nah, his voice is too annoying. Let's not, I don't want to work with him. And now the opposite is true. So I thought that was quite funny. Ended up doing Canonical Chronicle myself, and I was just determined to like show them that I could make it something, and I have. So
in terms of, like, obviously Same Rush exposure, I can relate to it, and, you know, would never say it's bad exposure. The question I want to ask is, you know, doing it yourself or doing it for Same Rush, you know, has its, you know, Same Rush get you instant exposure, but again, you've went down the kind of sleeping with cockroaches route and doing it yourself. Was that relatively easy to build up for you, or was that just being consistent and churning it out and people will eventually like it? You know, what's your kind of thoughts and how that built up?
When I first had a look at all the content out there, that there was no funny, like, there was a real void left. See, when Rand stopped doing Whiteboard Fridays and they're just randoms doing it, they are good. Brittany Mueller's phenomenal. She's an absolute tour de force. Cyrus is really good as well. But there's something about Rand that was just really, really good. I couldn't put my finger on it, and there was a bit of a kind of hole left in the kind of SEO content space. I know Neil Patel does a bunch of stuff, so does Brian Dean, but it's very informational. It's not funny, or it's not that it's engaging because it's useful content, but it's not entertainment. And I just thought, well, if we can do some sort of something entertaining, because I remember speaking to you and we were like, the industry is dry as fuck, like it needs to be, it needs to be funnier. We need to take ourselves less seriously. At the time, I think we're getting a bunch of jip from people in different kind of scenarios as well. And we're like, oh, let's just try and keep our high spirits and funny. And I think that's why we get on so well in the webinars. It's just because we are funny with it, and we try and have a laugh.
I think you've got to. I think life's too short to take everything too serious. And it is what it is. I mean, no matter what, Mr. Corporate, there's going to be someone out there who's saying you're a dick and, you know, stupid guy here trying to be, you know, the next Lauren Hardy or whatever you want to call it, is also going to get gypped. You can never humour everyone, and that's just the way it goes. But on to something else that I want to talk to you about, you know, your persona. You know, you've obviously done your Canonical Chronicle, and you're now seen as Mr. White Hat. And I know, listen, I'm the same. When I go out there, I don't go out to get people banned or websites banned or any of my projects banned. People have this misconception of what's White Hat, what's Black Hat and stuff like that. You know, I'm a businessman and I want to make sure that anything that I do invest in provides me with a positive ROI. And I just want to get your take on the kind of link building side of things, because I know you're now more open to link building and stuff. Not that you probably weren't ever open to it, but certainly when I spoke to you in the past, it was like, no, it's all PR and, you know, this, that, and the next thing. And I know, you know, the kind of project that you bought when we were on holiday in Portugal, your little kids' toy website, you know, you tried it out and, you know, done this and done that, and you've seen amazing growth on that. And out of curiosity, actually, have you actually done anything with that website since? Is it still lying there, just dead?
Funny story about that one. So I bought a bunch of links and pointed them to a bunch of pages, but I've not actually done anything to it at all, apart from change the Amazon affiliate ID to mine. And it's grown and grown and grown just with the links. So that site itself in January, it was in February, sorry, the commission went to absolute zero. And I'm like, well, fair enough. I've made my money, whatever. I've probably been de-indexed and I just wasn't that arsed. And then I was looking at SEMrush and all that. I'm like, ranking's going. Oh, well, never mind. But I didn't actually go to load the website. So for some reason, I went and I tried to load the website and it was offline. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. And so I go through my emails and it turns out that I just forgot to pay the hosting bill. an absolute bell end. So I put it back up and put it back online and it's ranking again and making money again. So when it comes to building, I started as a black hat. Did I ever tell you that?
Yeah. Scrape box and all that stuff.
Yep. Bookmark Demon, X-Rummer was an absolute dream. Scrape board, not a lot of people talk about that. Scrape board was the forum spam version of Scrape box. SE Nuke, that was good. But I've not done it in eight. I wouldn't know what works anymore. If at all, because I've just not done it in so long.
That stuff is proper spam. In terms of, you know, what people think is, you know, guest posting, people say, I never buy a link, you know, don't do this and don't do that. I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
It depends who you're dealing with. So if I'm building links for one of my multinational corporate clients, not only is it a bad idea because it creates footprints and it could potentially damage them, they're so big that it's never going to move the needle, because you need to have such huge power to rank for the term jeans, just jeans, massive head term, or like motorbikes, massive head term. Like, how do you rank for that? Probably not with guest posts. But if you're running an e-commerce website and you want to get some links into a page, this is the problem with PR, is it usually goes, the links go to the homepage or a blog post, not the product. So you have to put guest posts into the mix. You can be smart with it. You don't need to be the dummy who's doing an advanced operator saying in URL, write for us plus keyword, like a million other SEO guys, and then buying a link on some bullshit article site. You can be smart about it. Find the best links to buy are actually the ones based on who you know. So like getting introductions to site owners that either you know or I know, and doing it like that is the smart way to do it. So like back channeling and relationship building. But guest posting works. We do it at scale for our clients. So we sometimes pay for them, we sometimes don't. It just depends on what's happening. And I've spoke to a lot of agency people who will not publicly admit to doing it, which I think is really disingenuous. And we have to have a grown-up conversation about what works and what doesn't. Yes, getting links in the Telegraph and the Guardian is where we should be going, but it's expensive, it's hard, it takes a long time. And let me talk to you about ethics, actually. Do you think it's ethical? So if I know exactly how to rank a website, but I deliberately choose not to do it, but still take your money every month because of some white hat, black hat ethics debate, am I being the good guy or the bad guy? I know how to rank it and I'm deliberately not.
I would say you're being the bad guy, of course. You know, if you're taking someone's money and not implementing what you know, because people are not coming to you for the good or the bad guy, in my opinion. People are coming to you to rank a website and utilize your experience and everything else to rank their business. And these guys don't know what bloody white hat or black hat is anyway. They should just be coming to you. I'm not saying, you know, certain clients will probably give different instructions, but in most cases, people are coming to you saying, Ross, come on, man, you've lived with cockroaches, you've scrimped and scraped your way up there, do some of that shit for my business. You know, how do you, and you know, you should be implementing what you know rather than, you know, what you believe to be the right thing as such. And that's
like
where
it's a better place. Like the whole PR versus guest posting thing, we try and get it to a better place. So you don't need to spend money on creative to do good PR. And if you regionalize it, it really works well. So if you get a random data set for somewhere in America, there's 2,500 local and regional newspapers in the States. They've all got a DR of 80+. And I can programmatically email every single one of them with a perfect story. 10-20% will say yes and put it live. So there you go. You've just got your client 200-400 DR 80 links in the matter of a couple of months. That doesn't happen all the time. Of course it doesn't. But the times it does, it completely transforms our business. So pros and cons.
I think with anything though, it's all about doing things in moderation. You know, if you're going to do, you know, guest posts or whatever it's going to be, you know, do it in moderation and do it with some kind of purpose. Don't you go out and, you know, spam it. You know, I think, you know, for me in terms of how I conduct my own brand and stuff like that, I'm not wanting to do anything that's going to risk that and, you know, get some, you know, fire up GSA or any of that kind of garbage. You know, it is all about appearing in podcasts and putting the time in. And if I get some PR, great. It's not always good PR that I get, but okay, I can work on that. But, you know, I think doing things the long-winded way definitely is the way that it works. You know, obviously there's the odd little thing here or there that might be slightly sketchy, but, you know, if you want to talk about, you know, white hat and black hat, but at the end of the day, I think it's a case of doing what works, and that's what keeps clients in the long term. So, and that's where, you know, I think a lot of people say, Craig, you're just an agency basher and this and that because an agency didn't work for you. I'm, you know, an agency did work for me. I had a successful business from it, and I don't like bashing agencies. The real thing I do bash is that whole thing where people are seeing one thing and doing another, or not implementing what they actually know works and taking people's money. That's what I have a problem with. And I think a lot of agencies are set up in that way. I'm not saying any specific agency, but I think there's a lot of agencies out there who will take your money and not implement what works. They're doing something completely different.
I was to tell you then, we've had a client now for 6 months and we've done zero implementation. I've billed them every single month and we've done no implementation, but I've given them documents. Do you think that's, what do you think about that?
It depends on what's on those documents. You know, I think, you know, you're going to tell me something ridiculous like this is a 2 or 3 year project and, you know, it needed 6 months worth of documents to then go on and implement it. So that would be a good thing. If it's taking you 6 months to pull everything together, document this stuff, and I don't know the purpose of that client as well. You might be passing that on to a development team. There might be that much wrong with the website that's taking you 6 months to document it. Then that's good value for money. And hopefully that client, if they implement that stuff and have the budget to do that, then that's a good thing. I mean, on the flip side of that, I've had people come to me saying, Craig, I've been to this agency and, you know, they've took my money for 3 months and they've come back with some keyword research. I mean, that's a piss take. So it really depends on what's in that document. And knowing you, there's going to be a lot of stuff, actionable stuff. And, you know, you pulled a lot of stuff, done a lot of site audits and, you know, Lighthouse and everything else, and pulling all that together to then go and give them a plan of action is going to give them value. So I couldn't knock that, you know, so that is what you're going to tell me, right?
You've nailed it, actually. Yeah, so that's for a national insurance brand. And in order to get anything on their site, we need to make business cases. In order to make business cases, there needs to be like a full throughput of why we're doing it, data-led and all the rest of it. So all we're doing is we're once we win the client's business, we're then in a mode of internally pitching all the different people in their business to get shit done. And if we get them to implement like a title tag update, it can be 3 months, it can be 6 months, because there's so many layers of stuff we need to go through to get it done. Other times, I literally, the first thing I do with small businesses, I put them on links immediately. Same way when you go into a hospital, they put you in a drip, regardless of what's wrong with you. So I just think it's a smart thing to do. So it depends.
It depends. But I think with people like you, you know, and you know, we've got loads of guys in this industry who are all very smart. You know, your Jerry Whites, your Nick Wilsdens, and, you know, I could go on and on and on with very smart SEO guys in this industry. And you would know that if they said it's going to take 3 or 4 months for documentation, then that's what the job is. But as I say, it's the disingenuous, horrible agencies. You know, some teaser who's just ripped someone off for 6 months and then hands them some shoddy document that says, you know, here's your top 20 keywords. Here's, you know, you might want to do some internal linking. You know, it's just a joke. It's beyond a joke.
That is a joke. And the thing is, there's a lot of that out there. But if you think about an agency as a business type, it's actually quite a shit business, because you think of the people that's doing the work. So you create frameworks and you create templates and systems so that every time a new client comes on, you can do it faster and cheaper for them, so you can get more margin out of it. But if you then think about the people that are doing it, you're trying to find people who don't know their true value yet, and you're technically underpaying them for a period of time, and then they leave in 2 years, and that's the entire agency model and agency cycle. You've got a bunch of smart strategists at the top actually working out how to do all this stuff. And you've got a bunch of very junior people that are happy to learn on the job and they're doing the implementation. Because if you think about the financial model of an agency, we have a day rate. So we'll charge £600 a day, which for London is very cheap.
The whole agency?
£600 a day blended rate for the entire agency.
Yeah, I mean, that's cheap.
Yeah, I think so. But because of that, trying to give them value inside of that, you need to be, and also we do a 4-day work week. So I've immediately taken 20% of my margin and put it in the bin.
Yeah.
It's hard work. So the model needs to be right. A lot of people are just templatizing things and bashing it out, which is the wrong way to do it. Teaching people first principles and then giving them thinking frameworks instead of doing frameworks. That's how we would typically do all that. But most agencies are not set up for that. They've got a framework that if you as the client do not fit in it, they're just going to smash you into it. And if you don't get results, they don't care, because they've signed you up to a 12-month contract with no break clause, and they'll take your money and you'll churn just like everyone else. So it's a pretty awful business. So doing it differently, that's probably why we've been so successful, because we don't do things like that and we retain our clients.
Yeah, but one question I do want to ask, you know, out of agencies in general, there's a lot of waffle, as you said, you know, in terms of internal pitching and all this kind of bullshit that goes on, which I would find personally very frustrating, because I'm more of a guy that just wants to get his hands dirty and, you know, fix things, or, you know, delegate things to get fixed or whatever it's going to be. But, you know, realistically out there, clients must be hemorrhaging a serious amount of money on all this kind of waffle, if you like, if you want to call it that, you know. And I know it has to be done and stuff like that, but in terms of working for that, you know, that big client there that you mentioned, the you know, the 6 months worth of documentation, you know, how much actual SEO work gets done on a client like that? You know, there must be millions spent. You know, what percentage wise, you know, with dealing with that kind of business, is actually going to be done on pitching and all the kind of bullshit, and how much is actually going to get done on implementation? Surely it must be 20% on implementation, 80% on bullshit that doesn't actually mean anything.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, for some of the national clients or the international clients, it'll be probably 50-50. At the start, so the first 6 months is usually like auditing and documentation. But actually, see, once you're in, you can get a lot done really quickly. So we went from a period of, with this particular client, 6 months of absolutely nothing to every single week pushing new live updates to the site because we were in and they trusted the process. And that site's now got a 30% increase in year over year traffic, which doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're doing tens of millions of clicks, that is a lot. But it took, there's a phrase that says, if I had an hour to cut down a tree, I'd spend the first 45 minutes sharpening the axe. And that's kind of what we're doing here.
Yeah. No, it's interesting stuff. But you've got to do what you've got to do. And the client's always right in that respect. If you need to do internal pitches, that's all good and well. But what I'd love to know is clearly you cannot physically audit every website and be involved in every single part of that process. You've got guys in your office who do certain parts of it, but I'm assuming you still do a lot of the pitching, right?
Would I do all the sales, yeah. But in terms of like day-to-day client management, it's not me. That was a hard one, actually. A lot of the clients complained about that early doors because they felt like they were buying me. We've got 25 clients. I mean, one of them, for example, is like a couple million URLs. Like, I can't do that. That's a team of people. That's not just one person.
Yeah.
I forgot your original question, but no, I don't do it. We've got an account structure, so we don't have departments. So usually you'll have the SEO team, the tech team, the PR team, the design, whatever. We have client teams, so we'll have two portfolios, and they've got about 10 to 15 clients in them each. And we actually base it off of a total retainer value. So each portfolio has got X amount of monthly spend, and that's managed by group account directors. And they have account managers underneath them, and they have executives underneath them.
Interesting. No, I think the problem we both probably face, though, is people want you. People buy into people. They probably couldn't give a shit about Type A Media, to be honest. People buy into you. And I had a guy the other week there, actually, who wanted training with, us. I say us because it's, I do have a team as well. And the client came to us and said, right, we need some consultancy on this, which is fine, I can consult. We need some training for some content writers to understand how to do keyword research, internal linking, adding it to the websites and all that bullshit. And we need, some of this and some of that. So they went, yeah, that's all good. We pitched them. We said, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And then the client phoned up and said, it has to be Craig that does the training. For the kind of content people and my business partner Colin's like, do you really think Craig's going to be teaching people how to do keyword research? Like, his time is not best suited to that. How do you deal with that? People are buying into you as a person, but maybe not always getting you at the meeting. Is that a problem? And if so, how do you resolve that? Because I'd love to know for my own personal benefit, because it's a pain. I'm not going to sit there and, I've trained guys and guys who've delivered training courses for years and years and years and shown someone how to use Google Analytics or something. I'm not interested in talking about it, and I'm not going to deliver that part of the training. For something more advanced, of course, I'll come in and be part of that. Are you the same?
I'm exactly the same. So clients will say things like, you're just getting the top brass out for the pitch and then we're just going to get some juniors at the end of it. And the answer is yes and no. So what I'd say to them is, do you want your senior strategist to be sitting on your website changing broken internal links? Or are you happy with one of the juniors doing that? They're like, well, obviously one of the juniors. I'm like, right. So the way in which we've done it is I train them the training is very full on at Type A. We've got frameworks for everything. You've probably heard me talk about REST and Boom and Disco and the 4Ds and all that sort of stuff. And that's what they get. And what I'd say to them is, like, the reason why you actually don't want me on your account because I'm not good is the answer. Because I'm not, like, if you want to audit like a website, you want my group account director to do that because he or she is absolutely phenomenal at that, and they do it all day, every day, uninterrupted. I don't. I put together strategy decks on what we need to do to get this into your business. So actually, it's pick the right person for the right job, and it's just being humble with them and being like, you know what? Like, if you want tech, let's get the tech guy, the specialist to do that. I can do a bit of all of it, but you really want the specialist. And that's the whole point of buying an agency, is you get a little bit of everyone's specialism in one package. Yeah. So the idea that they want me, what am I good at? Talking shite, that's my main.
That's a good way to put it, and as long as your ego allows you to joke about it in that way. Because at the end of the day, we all have teams and processes, and you know, we have to delegate stuff, because as you say, you cannot go and crawl a million URLs, or you know, cast your eye over a million URLs, or whatever the hell it's going to be. And you know what, we wouldn't want you doing that either. Your time is better suited to coming up with some lame jokes and doing the canonical chronicle. But I think it's one of those things. We'll just have to deal with it. There's no right or wrong answer. People are still saying that's got to be him, and I've never found a good solution to that. But other than doing crappy videos and scaring people off, they don't want to deal with me. That's what I'm trying now with this TikTok thing and everything else, just scare people away from me, going, this guy's fucking insane.
Get him. You don't need videos for people to think that, Craig.
Yeah. But just to end it, because we don't want to bore everyone to death with agency talk and stuff like that. But what's new? What's going to be happening going forward? Is it going to be more of the same agency life? Are you going to delve into some other stuff? Are you going to invest in stuff? I know you invest your money in stocks and things like that. But you know, is there anything else that you haven't told anyone yet? What the plans are for the future?
Yeah, I don't think the agency model is going to be around for the next few years. I think it's a kind of bust of an industry, or I will need to I think my friend Chris Simmons says that he thinks that SEOs will be the same way that accountants are at the moment. The software will get so good, Google will get so good, that you'll need a top level consultant or a strategist. You won't really need anyone to do any implementation. And the function of an agency will very rapidly change. It's typically agencies, the thinkers or the doers. And we're a kind of mixture of both. I'm moving into product. So I've got a tool called Needle that we're building. So we've got a dedicated team of people, 6 people sitting constantly just dedicated to it. Needle is essentially something that it's a journalist search engine where you can put any piece of content in and it'll match it to 100 million articles from the Google News API and give you the exact journalist that you need to contact. We're building a lot more SEO tools as well as part of that. So that's where our big focus is going to be in terms of diversification. The agency bit, we're also just growing into exclusively enterprise-only clients. So we're saying no to a lot of the smaller businesses that we work with now, or they ask to work with us, and we're only going for large brands, the way we can actually make a difference. And we're training our people to be top, more like management consultants than SEO people. So that's the kind of way that we're starting to move it, so that you'll come to us for the strategy and the documentation, not for the implementation.
One other thing I do want to ask you, and I think I'm not sure if your things your thoughts changed on it. I know at one point you mentioned to me last year that you were always going to have clients on a kind of level retainer. You didn't want to work with big, big, big clients, because if one of them drop off, it could affect, you know, it impacts 30% of your revenue. Is that, you know, I know you're saying you still want enterprise clients, but are you still trying to implement a kind of level retainer structure as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So with the PR and outreach stuff, it's all productized, so there's a single cost. So it's a 5K for every campaign, it's 5K a month retainer. And then you buy an asset to do the outreach, which is typically a one-off fee between 6 and 10 grand. So to do like a decent campaign every quarter, you're looking at 25 grand. And that's just a fixed rate. The reason is because the bell curve of outreach, it's interesting. See, when you're doing any sort of outreach stuff, there's only so much that you can build lists and pitch people for any given idea. So that's actually, there's a hard limit to the amount you can do there. You can increase your day rate and your prices, but it gets less competitive for the clients. So I've moved to that, yep. But I'm actually now moving into like enterprises based on whatever they need, and it's a bespoke fee structure. The reason being, we do link building for some of the biggest retail businesses in the world, and some of the smallest little niche e-commerce stores in the world. It's the same work. The difference being that one will pay you 30 grand to do it and expect 10 links a month, and one will pay you 3 and expect 100 links a month. So you can get a lot more of those small e-commerce ones, and you can actually move the needle a lot more for them. But for the exact same work, I'd rather get paid considerably more, which sounds very greedy, but it's just business, really.
Business is business, and you've got to see it as a business transaction. And that's why we're all here at the end of the day. You want to sail off into the sunset with wads of cash and tell your story or whatever's going to be. But no, I think it's interesting to hear your thoughts on becoming more of a consultant and strategist than you know, doing the kind of donkey work. And I think Chris Simmons is the that's obviously, you've said that's his thoughts. I think I would tend to agree with that. I think agencies are going to die out over the next few years, and just because clients are becoming more and more aware and more savvy and want training and stuff like that, then yeah, I think people like you and building your brand is a key part of trying to maintain that presence there. So that's good. And hopefully the needle tool, if you ever need a beta tester or anyone to try and pick it apart, give me a shout, man. I'd definitely be up for having a go on that and seeing what the hell you've got there, because I love tools and automation and everything. So be keen to see that. When are these kind of tools coming out? Is there any kind of launch date? Or
1st of May, everything's coming out. So we're going to have a big, if we actually had a cinema booked to do a big launch party. So our videographer's doing some proper like advertising style videos and stuff like that. But because of this fucking virus, I think we'll need to cancel the launch party.
My invite lost in the post.
Oh, so it's not when nobody's been invited yet, but you would be the crown jewel at the front of the show, definitely. But the tool, yeah, if you want it, I'll send it over to you to test it. If anyone's listening to this who wants to test it, email me ross@typemedia.co.uk and I'll send you a link to it to test it out. It looks pretty good, man. I'm pretty happy with it. What we're going to do with it after the initial release is going to be quite interesting. We're setting up an affiliate program for it, 60% commissions lifetime. So hopefully that will help us grow it pretty considerably.
60%? Fuck me.
Yeah.
That would have to be the highest of commissions for a tool that I've actually heard of.
I want people to work hard for it. And the plan is just to get it massive. It's not really to make money off of it.
Yeah. And that means that rather than, because I'm tight as fuck, as you know, rather than paying you 5K for a PR, this shit might help me get some PR.
Exactly right. So if you write your press release, it uses natural language processing to pull out all the entities in it with a salience score. So if you're writing about SEO, the salience score would be 1. Then inside that, you'd have things like SEMrush salience score of 2, and it would go down and down and down. If I then compare that to the last 100 million fresh articles from the Google News API, it will literally do the exact same thing to them and match it with the weighted score, and then give you the email address and all that of the journalist. Eventually, you'll be able to just click a button and pitch them without needing their email. But that's for phase 2.
Interesting stuff. Well, I won't waste any more of your time, Ross, because it's probably been a long day and we've both been on a webinar prior to this as well. So talking you probably don't want to do, and you want to go away, but it'd be great to have you on again in the future, even to talk about the tool specific that you're launching. We could do a show on that if you're up for it, get a bit of promotion going to that, because smart guys are always making smart things, and I think the audience would love to dig deeper into that tool and what it does and all that kind of stuff. So we hopefully will be able to get a hold of you at some point in the future as well. But for anyone watching, Ross Tavendale, RTavs online, and I will have all your links to your website and your social media and everything else down below. He's an approachable guy, Not a real Glaswegian, though, with that accent. We need to do that. We come from not far away from each other, but the accents are so different. People are always like, why do you not sound more like Ross? Who's the real Glaswegian?
That would be you. I actually, my own accent annoys the shit out of me because I know how pretentious it sounds to anyone from Scotland. My mum went to elocution lessons when she was a kid, and she's got like she's very well spoken. And then we then inherited that from her. And then I moved to England, and being around English people all day, being on a conference call, you've got a guy from Italy, a guy from India, a guy from Scotland. Like, it doesn't help to have a thick accent. So yeah, it's kind of tapered down a little bit.
And what about Gordon, your dad, who is a legend in my eyes? He gives you stick, so what's his accent like? Is it more like mine?
Closer to yours, yeah. So it's a little bit more. Although we're technically, it's not Glasgow, it's Curlook, which is like in between Glasgow and Edinburgh. So it's got that kind of weird. Yeah, it's not quite Glaswegian, is it? It's kind of like just countryside banjo player type stuff.
Out in the sticks. I think the weird thing with Glasgow and the surrounding areas is, if you go 20 miles, you know, down south towards Ayrshire, they've got this weird twang, you know, 20 or 30 miles over to your neck of the woods, it changes. And then, you know, 20 minutes down the road from you, get into Edinburgh, they're all talking about Ken, whoever the hell this Ken guy is.
So, I've been in Edinburgh for a long time, so that's probably where I got a lot of that as well. They don't trust Glaswegians. When I get hired at LBI, a guy called Robin Richmond, who I think he was a group account director at the time, he's like, oh, you're a Ouija. Oh, you must have slipped through the net. We don't trust them. I'm like, fuck, okay.
That's weird. Weird it stuff. But anyway, we'll stop waffling and let you get back to going to your online parties with the geeks.
I'm going to venture outdoors and get a takeaway because I've been inside for 3 days and I'm going absolutely mad.
I'm the same. But, well, not so much a takeaway. I just get cabin fever and don't like takeaways. But no, thank you very much, Ross, for coming on. It's been a pleasure and finally good to get you. So cheers, man.
Thanks, then, very bud. Really appreciate it.
Cheers.